Hello and welcome to the Colts Cover 2 podcast. This is Joel A. Erickson. This is our first episode here without Jim Aiello. I've got Brent Fadig here from Naperville, Illinois. You probably know him better as at Fan of Nuance on Twitter. I got to say, I'm kind of surprised that your Twitter account didn't immediately get you banned. Nuance is not what Twitter wants.
Absolutely. Joel, thanks for having me. Fan of Nuance needed to be called out because you're right. It's not welcomed anywhere in any Twitter conversation. And so I'm battling against the tides trying to try and enter a little bit in there. Sometimes I fail, but I attempt.
We're here. Colts are sitting at 0-1. I've just been out to practice where didn't see Quentin Nelson, didn't see Darius Leonard. Braden Smith has a foot injury. Quiddy Pay has a hamstring. Xavier Rhodes was kind of doing some running at the end, but still isn't practicing. I guess, how from a member of the fan base, how are you feeling right now?
Yeah, par for the course, I guess, as a long-term Colts fan on the injury front. It does just feel like, you know, all-stars can't be all-stars once they get paid. And injuries are part of the deal anyway, right? It is football. So I appreciate that. But coming off of a week one loss, a game that at times did feel within reach, it's not encouraging to have the lineup of the next four games knowing that you got guys already battling stuff and we're just in week two.
Okay, so this gets into what I wanted to talk about with you today. Bill Barnwell had a great tweet. You know, the Colts obviously lost to Jacksonville last year in week one. Tom Brady threw a pick six, and the Bucs lost by 11. The Browns, I think, lost by 30 in week one last year. The flip side of that is that there are some teams who got beat badly at the beginning of last year and ended up being bad. So where are you on what's your feeling on this team right now? How are you taking the week one loss?
Yeah, it feels like the type of thing I try to pound the table every year on, right? This is overreaction week. Is it fun to have overreaction week year after year with a Colts loss? No. We all know the statistics, right? Once you go 0-2, your shot at making the playoffs is almost nil. Does a 17-game season change the odds a little bit? Yeah. But you're not piling up wins in the early part of this season unless you're hitting on all cylinders. Were there encouraging signs in week one? Yeah. The football cliches are abundant, but, you know, I went back and looked at Carson Wentz's throws. He didn't look like he felt like he had to play hero ball. He was not throwing off rhythm. He had a lot of pressure in his face, but on the downs that he had a fairly clean pocket, it looked like he was making the reads, and it looked like he was throwing fairly accurate balls. One very specific stat I pulled off of Kevin Cole's Twitter feed at PFF is in 2021 week one, which small sample size, right? He had the second best percentage of negatively graded play rate. And in 2020, he had the absolute worst. So Carson Wentz and Frank Reich have a lot of history of showing they can do good things together. Did we see some of that on Sunday? Yes. Was the rest of the team completely off of their normal play performance? Kinda. So that's where I'm at, Joel. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I'm the same as you are. When it comes to week one, when I was covering the Saints, I'm pretty sure, I might get the score wrong here, but I'm pretty sure that I saw a playoff Saints team get beat like 42-14 or 38-14 or something like that by Ryan Fitzpatrick's Tampa Bay Buccaneers. There are performances in week one that you just kind of have to throw out. And we'll find out if this is one. We might not find out this week, given some of the injury questions that we're dealing with here. But you brought up Wentz. I agree with you. I thought Wentz looked, for the most part, really, really good. Some of the plays that he probably could have taken more sacks, honestly. I know that they were. I know that they felt like he could have done some stuff pre-snap. Wentz himself kind of said like he thought that there were some protection things he could have got them in better protection. But the times that I remember and noted a free rusher coming loose, Wentz actually completed passes on a lot of those. I'm thinking specifically there was one that a guy came off the edge down in the red zone and he hit Mike Pittman for a gain right away and took the shot, and it was really impressive that he got the ball out. I think that going into it, that was the biggest question for all of us was, how's Wentz going to play? Is he going to make the right decisions? And from that standpoint, I thought he maybe was the best Colt on Sunday.
Yeah, it's wild to think that the guy who had five practices going into Sunday looked like one of the best players on the field, if not the best. But from the eye test, that's what I got. I think we all walked into last Sunday expecting a really run-heavy game plan, right? Wentz has barely practiced. His timing with the receivers is going to be dubious at best. And Seattle really shut down the run game, I think, early. And yet, Jonathan Thomas still had a pretty darn good game. All-around yardage, he was over 100 yards for the day. If Jonathan Taylor is getting 60 yards receiving week in, week out, I think there's great things coming, right? Because he was not known as a pass receiving back coming out of Wisconsin. And yet last year and this year has shown him to have some extremely reliable hands. Plus, we know once he gets in a rhythm and he has an offensive line that's playing together and maybe has starting caliber left tackle play, the guy is going to get it done in the third and fourth quarter for you. So there was a lot to say that Wentz was the best player on the field, but I would argue that that maybe Taylor had an underrated performance.
That's pretty good. You know, I always thought that the pass catching thing on him was overblown. I'm originally from Wisconsin, and my dad is a huge Badgers fan. So a lot of Saturdays, I'm watching the Wisconsin game and then talking to my dad about it. And his last year there, they started throwing the ball to him, and it really was pretty obvious that he knew what he was doing, and Wisconsin just hadn't really thrown it to him before. So his prowess in the receiving game has never really surprised me. It's kind of always been there. He got so many carries at Wisconsin. I don't know if everyone understands, like, he would get 25 carries week in and week out. And one of the ways they tried to keep him from getting touches, which is hilarious because it's kind of hypocritical to say, oh, we're going to not throw it to him to keep him from getting touches, but we'll definitely hand it off to him 30 times, was to not play him in the passing game as much his first couple of years. But they were doing some stuff his junior year where, you know, they were doing some of the stuff that you sort of see the Colts do with Nyheim Hines, the receiving back type stuff. So, yeah, I definitely think that's a part of the game. I saw some people kind of going at Wentz for throwing some national people. I feel like this was maybe a PFF thing. I can't remember. But for throwing too many throws to the running backs and not enough to the wide receivers. And it's one of those things that I feel like you maybe look at it on the paper and you're like, oh, okay, he didn't throw very much downfield. But he was getting killed.
Right.
I think within the context of the game, I don't think that I ever thought, you know, Wentz is pulling off of this. I mean, I'm sure he missed some reads. I don't think anybody, even including like Phillip Rivers, has perfect games on that stuff. But there were a lot of throws that they had to, and Frank Reich backed this up this week by saying that a lot of times when they had shot plays called, Wentz made the correct decision to pull off of that and then go to the running back. And at some point, those running backs, I think Nyheim and Taylor, at some point they're going to turn some of those short throws into big throws. It didn't happen last week, but I thought Seattle's defense actually was better than I expected. I thought they swarmed the ball in a way I was not fully expecting from them.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a factor to pay attention to moving forward for Colts fans, right? Like, yeah, we lost, but was there a clear indication that Seattle was the better team on the field on Sunday? I felt like that defense, the defensive line specifically, played incredibly well. Daryl Taylor, who didn't even play last year, was just completely dominant, made Braden Smith, the guy that never gives up sacks or pressures at all, looked feeble. maybe that was a foot injury thing. I think we'd probably be not surprised to find out that foot injury occurred early in the game. But still, that defensive line was dominant. And there weren't a lot of receivers open downfield upon my couple viewings. So I don't blame Wentz for going to the check down option, especially when you got Nyheim Hines, who just got paid on, what, Saturday. They probably came in going, let's feature this guy a little bit. And well, then, again, we talked about Taylor.
Well, and also, like, isn't Carson Wentz not forcing the ball what everybody wanted him to do?
Right.
Forcing the ball got Carson Wentz into a lot of trouble last season when he was trying to win games by himself. I don't know that him not doing that is some sign. I think that's I think there's going to be all season long, I think this is going to be something that Colts fans have to deal with and that we're going to have to deal with as writers, is just there's a narrative around Carson Wentz now. And there's a militant Philadelphia fan base on Twitter, for those of us who are on Twitter, that cannot stand Wentz. And they're going to twist whatever he does into a negative play. And so we're going to have to filter some of that out because, like, I know I kind of went to bed Sunday night feeling like, you know, Carson Wentz played really well. And then I got up and I saw a couple of critiques of him and I was like, oh, did I miss something here? And then I watched the game again. And I was like, no, I still think Carson Wentz played pretty good football.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing how, especially on Twitter, there's just kind of a zeitgeist about who we like and who we don't like, right? Like, and I remember the Jacoby year, he started off looking like a competent quarterback, and how can you not love Jacoby Brissett, the human? So everybody loved him, and then anybody that was even mildly critical of him just got lambasted in their mentions because it was unfair to critique Jacoby Brissett. And yet Carson Wentz, yeah, people pick him apart, especially in Philly. But I do think you're spot on to suggest that there's kind of this perception you have to help work against because people have already decided who Wentz is. I know I kind of did. So I'm trying to let Sunday's play be the merit that I evaluate the guy on. Did he look like Luck? No. Was he doing a couple Luck-like things in the pocket every once in a while? Kinda. Do I want him to keep the ball a little more secured so we don't have some fumbles? And I don't know if that one was even counted as a fumble when he took off on the running play. And then, of course, there's the botched snap. But that's stuff that gets fixed when a guy is actually practicing. So writing the narrative on what Carson Wentz is and what went down in Philly is something for future generations to do. I think it's good and healthy for Colts fans to just try and evaluate the Carson Wentz that we're seeing playing number two, and let that speak for itself.
Yeah, I felt like that there was a point, like I felt like we needed to ask questions to Wentz about Philadelphia in his very first press conference there, and then I really felt like moving forward, we kind of have to bring it down to what he is now and what we're seeing now and what's happening now. Because, I mean, I don't feel like I know exactly what happened in Philly. I know what the reports are. I've read all of them. There's some murkiness in there that I don't love in terms of when people said some things, what some of the people who would maybe, like, in terms of, like, the teammate thing, you know, Malcolm Jenkins, I think, was one of the guys that had been quoted as being critical of him, and then he came back and said, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's just learning some stuff. And there's, to me, there's a difference between those two things, you know. The way it comes from Philly often is that he is, I don't know, the worst thing that ever happened to them. I don't know.
Right.
But the players themselves, the ones who went on record, I don't know that we have that picture as clearly as you'd like to say some of those things. And he's in Indianapolis now. Guys can make mistakes in other places and learn from it. We usually talk about this and say, you know, things like he just needed a change of scenery or something like that. But sometimes the real thing behind that might not be that just that he switched to another city. Sometimes it's that they learn things. I think of Zach Banner, who has been much better, obviously, than he was in Indianapolis. And I've seen him a couple times now tell people that when Chris Ballard cut him, it woke him up and it taught him to be an NFL player because he realized what the stakes were and what he wasn't doing. So did Zach Banner need a change of scenery? Maybe, but what he really needed more was for someone to tell him, this isn't going right. You need to change. And that's why he ended up being good somewhere else. So some of that stuff, I wonder if you, like, how long can you hold somebody's past against them when, from all indications, they're aware of that past and trying to be better about it in the future?
Yeah. Humility is powerful. And I think Carson Wentz's 2020 was maybe his first dose of true humility. Yes, he went to North Dakota State, but that's a powerhouse in that area, and that's where the guy's from, right?
Right.
He was the guy in high school and college, and then he was the second overall pick. He had never really had to eat humble pie at any point. And I think that how 2020 shook out plays a role in how that man grows from that experience. The other, this is weird, but conspiracy theory-ish, but one of the factors I don't think really gets talked about enough is just like the humanity of these people. The guy had a baby and a pregnant wife during COVID. Don't you think any part of that might have just been like in the back of his head, making him question his choices? We watched Andrew Luck retire off an injury, probably at least in part because he had a daughter on the way. And I don't think any of that stuff ever gets talked about, because in football, men are just supposed to be, you know, piles of muscle on the field, moving other bodies around, but they are human. And I do think relationship stuff off the field always gets kind of completely lost until something bad happens. But I guess I've always given the guy a little bit of a pass, because there was probably a lot of stuff going on that we don't understand. And his first foray into being questioned as a dominant football force.
Well, so one of the things I think that happens with the humanity angle is that a part of it is that, you know, players have good reasons, I think, for not necessarily letting us know when stuff is going, when stuff outside is, because we've moved into a place now where we debate all that stuff. I mean, I think about like the comments about Dak Prescott when he admitted to having depression after his brother's death. There's a real negative, and it's not from all media outlets, but that's the thing is, like, just one of them really colors it for an athlete, you know? And so you see something like that happen with Prescott. You see where sometimes people are criticized for stuff that really just boils down to their dealing with life. And it makes players not want to talk about that stuff. So then even if, you know, somebody like me in the media asks them how that stuff is going, you get the boilerplate surface stuff. And so you,
right.
There's a real negative to admitting that there was maybe something going on outside. So it's hard to know. It's really hard to know when that stuff's going on unless they tell you. Because, I mean, on the flip side, you know, for somebody in my position, I can't just guess. I just can't, you know.
Right.
And so you ask, and if they don't tell you, it's you're kind of stuck. I mean, especially with something personal like that, there's only really one person who can tell you, and it's Carson Wentz. And if he doesn't want to, I mean, you can ask. I think one of the other things is that people sometimes are like, well, why don't you just ask different questions? And I'm like, I mean, you can ask it differently, but he's a smart guy. It's not like you can just change the wording and he'll be like, wait, that's a completely different question. Let me tell you the deepest, darkest parts of my soul.
Right.
That's just not how people work. So yeah, that's one of those things it's always tough. It's always tough sometimes that the information that we don't have, doesn't necessarily mean we didn't ask about it. I mean, sometimes we don't think about things. I know I'm kind of frequently going through my Rolodex when we find stuff out and thinking, what did I not do? But sometimes we ask the question and they don't answer, and they have reasons for it, and they're understandable reasons. Which is kind of a tough place to be, but I think you're right. I think there's there's a lot more that goes into some of these decisions than we know, and things that happen than we know. But there's such a penalty with some of the 24-hour sports talk stuff and the way stuff is taken, that I also understand from an athlete's perspective why they don't want to say things. It's one of the reasons that when somebody is very, very honest about something, like Sam Ehlinger sitting down with me and Zach Kiefer here at the beginning of the season and talking about his brother's death and how he dealt with it, that we're really appreciative of that, because they are putting themselves out there in a way where even if the two people they're talking to don't interpret it that way, somebody else outside can say, oh, well, I think he should have handled it this way, which is an insane thing to think, but it happens.
Right. Yeah, the level of nuance in this conversation is probably way too in-depth for a simple little week one diagnosis podcast, but I think it is it's your burden to bear, Joel, as a writer, is like you said, you're asking the questions to try and chip away at the shielded coaching that they've probably got on how to answer questions, how not to give away too much, or you know, there's guys that play with injuries that we never even hear about, right? That's an actual physical thing. So the mental stuff is shielded for a lot of reasons, and I they protect themselves probably against the locker room too, because they don't want to be a distraction. They don't want to be a headline for anything non-football related. That is critical to how the NFL seems to work. So that's why it's cool to see, you know, the franchise put an emphasis around mental health. I don't know that it's going to change how players answer your questions, but I think it's healthy that they at least let themselves go there.
Well, you mentioned the injury thing. So we asked Quentin Nelson about the other two surgeries that he'd referenced on his Instagram account when he got the foot surgery, and he said he didn't want to talk about it. And there was some pushback to us saying, why would we even ask that? But in the context of having a back injury that flares up now and again and we don't know about it, we had to ask the question just to find out, is there something going on here? Because I think the number one thing fans want to know is, why is this player not practicing, or why is this player not playing? What's going on here? Did somebody mess up? And one of the things that I don't think is a good answer for you guys is that sometimes we've asked the questions and we just haven't gotten answers that are revealing in any way. And right. So we're kind of at the mercy of, like, we know now that Quentin Nelson has a back issue that flares up. What's the severity of that? I have no idea. Quentin's not telling us that. Frank's not telling us that. I don't know what kind of chronic thing it is. It's just hard to know, because he obviously doesn't want to talk about it. And so when he's out of practice for 2 days, it's hard to guess. My guess is that Quentin Nelson's going to play if there's any way he can play. But it's a lot harder than having, say, an idea of what the injury is, how it works, all that stuff, and making a reasonable estimation based on prior information.
Right. I mean, I remember when the Wentz thing went down and people were up in arms going, like, how do you not know that? This guy's gone to the combine. He's had multiple teams check him out. They don't look at every nook and cranny of every person's body to find, you know, preventative care opportunity, right? It's more, there's an injury here that we need to look at. That's really all that the combine reveals and the teams necessarily know about. But Frank knows about Quentin Nelson's back thing. It's a known thing in the organization. So I would say, let's watch how the contract situation plays out with Quentin Nelson. He hasn't been paid yet. He deserves to be paid based on his play, absolutely. But if there's a genuine concern there with a back thing, that'll come into play when it comes time to negotiate a new deal for Quentin Nelson. I frankly was pretty confused when I saw Jack Muhort not have interest around the league a couple years ago, because other than a few kind of down years of nagging knee injuries, it wasn't like the guy was a poor player. And then Indy re-signed him and he retired before the season started. Especially on the offensive line, that's a big human putting a lot of wear and tear on the body. And if Quentin Nelson can't play 10-15 years in the league, it'll be everybody's loss. But if he has to manage a back injury daily, weekly, et cetera, that's not a good sign when you're in year, what, three?
Right, right. You know, it's interesting that you bring up the combine thing, because I actually asked somebody within the Colts, because there were so many people who were kind of saying, how do they not know about Wentz's foot? And I asked them about, you know, physicals, that kind of thing, combine stuff, because they said it was probably a high school injury. And I was told exactly what you said. It's not like they do, like, a full body scan where they're doing an MRI, X-ray, whatever, on your entire body. That's not – it's exactly what you said. They're doing old injuries, stuff that you know might be a problem. I don't know – the logistics, I've never had an MRI. I don't know how that works necessarily. But I don't think it's probably not feasible to do a full, complete, entire body scan of every single player that comes into your team. I just don't think it's probably feasible. And you would probably waste a lot of time looking at bones and joints and ligaments that were fine.
Right.
So steering this back a little bit to week one, I mean, all this is relevant because of who's on the injured list right now. But I guess, you know, you said for you, you're thinking, okay, it's week one. Let's just see what happens. What are your concerns going forward with this team? I have a few, but I want to hear yours first.
Yeah, definitely want to hear yours. Where I go first is the offensive line. Eric Fisher was not out there. Granted, Kelly and Nelson both missed a significant amount of training camp. Now we got Braden Smith with the foot. That I think has a direct influence on how efficient and how impactful the offense can be. And I just don't see in 2021 an NFL team with an inefficient offense doing much, right? In the playoffs, in the regular season, et cetera.
Yeah, that's fair.
You need to be able to throw the ball. You need to be able to run when you have to run. You need to have, you know, decent offensive line play, or else you're just going to be in the middle of the pack. So I have very specific questions about offensive line. I have very specific questions about the defensive backfield. You know, I think we'll see what happens if Xavier Rhodes can come back. But on Sunday, when I saw Kari Willis covering Tyler Lockett down the field, I got really sweaty, Joel. So well, I don't know if that's a defensive game plan issue, or if it's just we don't have the bodies that the team needs in the defensive backfield. Those are my two biggest concerns right now.
I will say this: I was a little surprised that the Colts came out blitzing Russell Wilson. I don't know Wilson's numbers off the top of my head against the blitz, but generally the rule of thumb that I always kind of operate by in the NFL is the more experienced and the better a quarterback is, the more blitzing can hurt you, because they're going to see it and they know where to go with the ball and they know how to get it out. So I was surprised on those first couple third downs to see blitzes coming, taking defensive backs out, sending seven on the first touchdown pass. Tyler Lockett, you were right to be sweaty. Tyler Lockett is a terrible matchup for Kari Willis. He just is. Like, Kari Willis plays strong safety. I think he's pretty good when you move him into coverage on tight ends. You don't want him covering one of the NFL's best deep threats. You just don't. You don't want to put him in that position multiple times.
To week one. Why are you letting your strong safety cover him down the field? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. The way that happened, especially on the cover two or cover six, I'm having some trouble with that. Some people have said cover six. Okay, hello and welcome back to the Colts Cover 2 podcast. I had a little bit of we might have cut Brent off a little bit there, but it was because my iPhone decided to stop working because it was too hot. So, still working on the technological stuff without Jim here. That's going to probably be an issue going forward. I apologize. We were talking about concerns. You mentioned the defensive backfield. Where are you on the corners? Where are you on the corners right now?
So, I think I love Chris Ballard, Joel. I think he's the right guy for the job. But I think no one is really talking about the fact he does not have a great track record at drafting cornerbacks. Quincy Wilson, Nate Hairston, Rocky Sin, Marvell Tell, Isaiah Rogers. Do I still have optimism that Rocky Sin can be a player at some point? Kind of. Marvell Tell, clearly they were willing to let be exposed to waivers. And I did see Rogers was actually getting outside corner rep. I think it'll be very interesting to see as the season moves on what they do with all those players, right? When Xavier Rhodes is healthy, we know what he looks like. When Kenny Moore is healthy, we know what he looks like. And then it's probably a combination of TJ Carey, Rocky Sin, Isaiah Rogers. And it's all going to depend upon who starts showing some level of consistency. I don't think that's going to be Rocky Sin. He feels very inconsistent based on his level of play the last 3 years.
Yeah, I agree with you on the corner position. The interesting thing to me is that corner was kind of Ballard's spot when he was in Chicago. Nathan Vasher is one of his best draft finds. He was pretty good at doing that there. I think there was also some ones he had in Kansas City where he found guys that maybe they weren't expecting to be good. But corner has been one of my concerns all along. TJ Carey, I think, is really good in a complimentary role like he played last year. I don't know if he's a starter. Certainly the league has not paid him like he's a starter. I really think they're kind of... The way they're set up, they need Rocky Sin to take a big step, and I'm with you. It's really hard to see that based on what we've seen so far. So corner was definitely one of mine. I'll give you another concern that I had going into the season, and I'm still not sure about after the first week. I don't know what to make of the defensive end position and the edge rush. I like Kwity Paye a lot. I like what I saw from him in camp. That's one guy that I think that is probably going to end up being good for the Colts. The other spots, there's just a ton of uncertainty at the other spots. And I don't fully understand some of the playing time rotation. I get that Al-Qaeda Muhammad is considered by the Colts to be a good run defender, but this is a passing league, and this is a defense that has struggled with the pass sometimes. And I got to be honest, I wonder after – it feels like we know what Muhammad is after a couple years here. And I kind of wonder why you have him in on so many snaps when you know you're not getting much pass rush production out of him.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like you said, I don't think we truly know what we have there. And all the reports out of training camp were how good they looked. I think in retrospect, that was fool's gold, maybe more of a reflection on the offensive tackle. Right?
Yeah, there was a chicken. There was a real chicken or egg situation going on there. Was it the defensive ends or was it the tackles?
Right. I made the point online when the first depth chart came out when Al-Qaeda Muhammad was listed as the starter. You know, everybody on Twitter started having a conniption, and I pointed out that there were multiple years, and this is before your time as a beat writer, Joel, but there were multiple years where Raheem Brock was the starting left end for the Indianapolis Colts during the Manning years. And Raheem Brock was a good player. He would come in on the NASCAR package inside, but he was mostly known as the left end, strong side, run defending, left and defensive edge presence. And that's kind of the same role as Al-Qaeda Muhammad. Do I think he had too many snaps when Seattle was still having their way with the Colts secondary and they were still passing when they didn't need to? Yeah. The whole Banigou thing, again, kind of overplayed, but I understand if he was designed to go in for NASCAR package and they didn't play NASCAR package, that impacts his snaps. But my question is, why weren't they playing the NASCAR package? Not who is in that and who is not in that, but why weren't they sending rushers? If they're busy blitzing, you're probably not necessarily counting on the NASCAR package. So again, it goes back to the play call.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's less the idea that he shouldn't ever play, and just it's got to be divvied up more. If that's your best pass rushing line, I feel like it's got to be on the field more than just third down sometimes.
Absolutely.
And I thought the Seahawks did a really good job of keeping themselves out of second and long situations. But, you know, this is a passing league. This is a team that wants more pass rush. They've been trying to get more of it. Like, let's see the NASCAR line a little bit more. Maybe there's more chances there to see what you have there and get better pass rush on there. I thought early on it looked like they were speeding up Wilson a little bit with that rush. And then I went back and looked. There were not a lot of chances, because out of the 9 third downs they had, 2 of them were third and ones. You're expecting them to run, and they did, I think. But maybe there's a way to figure out how to get that line in there in other situations and force teams to run when they want to pass. Now, on Sunday, I don't think that was the right thing because of the way the Colts were tackling, but I don't expect the Colts to tackle that way all season long. And I think sometimes forcing other teams to run in today's NFL and taking what they want to do away from them is a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would really have to do some research on it, but when you can start getting sacks on non-obvious passing downs, that's a really good thing for a defense, right? It definitely puts the defense in control of dictating where the other opposing offense is going to find success. And it is kind of strange to me how often there's a lot of base defense later on in the game. Especially if the opposing team's having a bunch of success, I don't understand why you wouldn't play a little bit more sub, just in general, right? We see the nickel on the field a lot, and that's why Kenny Moore's there. That's part of this defense. But this defense also thrives when you have consistent edge presence, you're forcing turnovers, and you're making offenses make mistakes.
Yeah, to your point on getting some of those plays, a sack on early downs, it's a negative play. And if anybody watched the fantastic Peyton and Eli Manning broadcast, like, just think about how many times Eli said when somebody had a penalty, oh, now you're second and 15 and you're really up against it. If you can get that with a sack, getting offenses behind the sticks is a good thing. No matter how it happens, it's a good thing to get them out of the situations they want to be in. And if you have to generate a little bit more pass rush by daring teams to run, again, I don't know that that's the worst thing, especially given the way this run defense has played over the course of 3 seasons, you know?
Yeah, I'd rather die trying. You know, I honestly, the pass defense is always going to be dubious when you're a cover 2 team. They're going to give up yards. They're going to, you know, force you to have to play them really well in the red zone. And that's just what Indy fans need to be prepared to watch week in and week out. But what I am not comfortable with is having absolutely no threat of a sack except for DeForest Buckner coming up the middle. That's a pretty tough pill to swallow.
Okay, well, Brent's got to get going here. So real quick, Brent, what are you thinking going into the Rams game? I'm assuming the injuries make it tough.
Yeah, it's that Rams team looked really good the other day, and it's hard to think week 2 is going to go much different than week 1. Does another week of practice for Carson Wentz make a major difference from his play? I don't think so. So, again, I think it's going to be up to the defense holding the Rams in check. But I will say this. This team's not going to win many games if they can't score 30 at the very least. So it really becomes about red zone efficiency and actually punching it in, and then figuring out how to master this this defensive scheme the way you and I were just talking.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the offensive line, depending on who's on the field, it just has to be better than it was last week. That game came down to the offensive line, and the Rams are going to be better, I think, up front. The Seahawks, I almost want to take a little bit of credit for Daryl Taylor because he was my guy in the draft, and then Jim was giving me crap all season for being like, hey, he didn't play, and he looked good last week. But the Rams have more established guys, and I think beyond just the passing game, if some of these guys are out, the run game didn't feel like there was a whole lot of room for Taylor or Hines.
Not at all.
Until we start seeing this offensive line play the way we expect to see it play and we're used to seeing it play, it's tough to see them come away with something. But anyway, thanks for joining me, Brent. I appreciate it a ton. I'm flying solo here for a little bit, so we're going to keep rotating hosts. But I really appreciate Brent's time. Follow him at Fan of Nuance if Twitter allows Nuance to be on its site for any length of time. And that's it for the Colts Cover 2 podcast. We'll be back on Sunday night with our first impressions. My editor, Nat Newell, will be in the other chair for that one. Thanks, guys.